Amen.
Thank you, worship team. Let's continue in worship by approaching the sacred scriptures. Matthew 23, one of the most unrecognized and bypassed chapters in all of the Gospels. You'll see a lot of movies about Jesus. You'll rarely see Matthew 23 ever included in the script. And that's because it is a series of scathing accusations that just don't film well. They don't remind us of the humble Jesus, and yet the humility of Jesus is at the very heart of these accusations and these confrontations with the leaders, because he sees them as representing God so wrongly, and he wants to draw them into a right way of leading, or better, serving or following. So Matthew 23, if you're there, we have spent a couple years in Matthew getting to this position where we have come. We have encountered Jesus go through a series of heated debates and dialogues with the religious professionals. Every time he's bested them, every time he's defeated their arguments. And if you remember a couple weeks back, we canceled last week because of weather. A couple weeks back, he silenced them. They had no more to say. That's the end of chapter 22, but that doesn't mean Jesus is silenced. He has a lot more to say about leadership. And thus he begins to argue for a new way of leadership by exposing the abuses of power that are represented by the people who have challenged him again and again. We're going to be looking at some pretty heated passages here. I know at the top of my Bible it titles chapter 23, The Seven Woes. I don't know if yours is similar, and that's what we'll cover next week, because beginning at verse 13, that's the first of woe to you, woe to you, woe to you, which is a prophetic way of pronouncing a curse or at least a dire warning toward one's hearers. But before we get to those seven woes, he wants to speak of ways power's been abused for one purpose and one purpose only. And it's important to get this, because sometimes we read these stories and think, boy, these Pharisees, they're just bad people. These religious professionals of Jesus' time, they're just so bad and they deserve this kind of confrontation. But of course, we know better. But the reason we know better, if we know better, is because Matthew preserved these arguments for Christian leaders. These are here that we might not make the same mistakes and fall into the same pits that the religious professionals of the past did. These are, if you will, sober warnings to Christian leaders, and you'll see it once we get to verse 8. He's going to, in verses 1 through 7, pronounce a series of accusations about all that he sees wrong, and then in verse 8 say, "But you are not to be like this," and then in verse 11, "The greatest shall be a servant," and so on. So he's addressing the Christian community by using this as an example of how not to do it, that we might learn from the mistakes, from the hypocrisy, from the pride, from the abuse of authority in the past. And so he begins in this way. If you come to verse 1 of chapter 23, and by the way, if you don't have a Bible on you, there's one under the seat in front of you or under your own seat. He begins in this way, verse 1. "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you.'" Now it's important to see that. The Pharisees, the teachers of the law, they sit in Moses' seat. That's a figurative way of saying they have Moses' authority. They come because in that society they're very privileged. Most people can't read. They're the literate ones. And so if you want access to Torah, to Moses' commands, you're going to have to hear it through a teacher of the law or through a Pharisee that can read it. Most people can't read this, and so they are at the whims of their teachers. And so Jesus says, when they read to you from the law, make sure you listen, because you want to do what they tell you to do. Verse 3, "You must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." In other words, listen very carefully to what you hear read, because for Jesus, the law is holy and righteous and good, as it is for all faithful, devout Israelites. The law is a gift. It's a good thing, and they're to listen to that. But they're not to listen to the way the Pharisees interpret it or practice it. Not because the Pharisees are intentionally trying to screw things up, but the commands and the burdens they're adding to God's law are unbearable. And the proof of the pudding in that is that they don't even practice them. They don't even lift their finger. Do not do what they do, verse 3b, for they do not practice what they preach. So the very first abuse of authority is the unwillingness to smoke what they sell. That they're willing to throw a bunch of commands people's way, but they're exempt from all of those commands. They can increase the burden on their hearers, but they see themselves as exempt from those burdens. They're failing to live out what they say with all their list of burdensome rules, but if someone else does that, they're going to catch you and they're going to call you on that. It'd be easy to live out the law if you understood that the very intent of it is love of God and love of others. Remember when Jesus is asked, what's the greatest command? Love God with all your heart, love your neighbors yourself. Show mercy, show compassion. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. When you reduce the law to its intent, its goal, what God's trying to prompt in God's people, it becomes a very light thing. But when you take the 613 commands of Torah, and then you add dozens of commands to each command so that you don't break each of the 613 commands, you end up with tens of thousands of regulations you're trying to follow daily. And when you break even one, you're accused immediately of being a lawbreaker. This seems to be what the Pharisees were doing. They were meticulous and rigorous in their religious practices, but they'd missed the spirit of the law. They'd missed the heart of it while they were very, very concerned about the letter of the law. And one of the proofs of that is that they proved to be merciless taskmasters when it comes to implementing that law, not in their own lives, but in others' lives. So verse 4, they tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. So the picture is of a pack animal, and they just add burden upon burden to this pack animal, but then they have nothing left for themselves because they feel like they've done their job by adding the burden to someone else. They are doing something that gives people no relief. They are stacked with thousands and thousands of petty, small things that they have to worry about daily. And while they're told to worry about them, the very ones who are challenging them in this direction are masters at avoiding the burden. You know why? They know the tens of thousands of loopholes. They know the way to bypass their obligation. Well, it's said that if you make a commitment to the temple, you better come through on that. But if you say, Corbin, this is meant for someone else, then you don't have to do that. All kinds of loopholes, all kinds of ways, once you know all these list of rules, to bypass the obligations because you know how to get around them. And so you're able to do that, but when it comes to others, you're strict. Strict on them, lenient on yourself, which is why Jesus has said earlier, they see the speck in another's eye while refusing to see the log in their own. That's the idea going on here. So it's a burdensome thing. They've made the law something that you come to despise, that you come to see as just a burden and not a liberation, not something that allows you to be open to love God and love others, but that actually weighs you down so you can hardly even move. This is in direct contrast to Matthew 11 when Jesus says, and you probably remember this, come to me, Jesus says, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Well, how will you give us rest, Jesus? Well, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Why is his yoke easy and burden light? Because he doesn't have tens of thousands of petty rules to follow. He says, love God, love your neighbor, show mercy, have compassion. Be a generous person. Things that get at the very heart of what God's trying to open up with the Torah, with that wonderful and holy law that God gives God's people. They're abusing the law. Jesus is allowing the law to give them wings and to actually live out what God has always wanted. So you have merciless taskmasters. You have these merciless taskmasters because ultimately, if you all look bad in the practice of your religion, that makes me look better. If I can give you and burden you with endless amount of rules and then find ways to bypass through loopholes, it makes me look really, really good why all of you are fumbling just to move along. And that's what's going on here. There's a flaunting of piety, and it's done through very interesting things in Jesus' society. Verse 5, everything they do is done for men to see. And of course, the tragedy of that is when you pray, go into your closet where only your Father sees, and your Father in heaven will reward you. That religion is to gain the notoriety and love of others rather than to show love of God. So they do things for men to see. And the way they do it, Jesus says, is they make their phylacteries wide. A phylactery is a leather pouch or a small box that the law actually makes note of in Deuteronomy 6. And the idea is you have this leather pouch where you've put four scriptures in it and you either tie it to your head or you tie it around your wrist. Some would have them in the door frames of their households. And the idea, it seems, was that if you tie it here, tie it here, or whether you just figuratively understand, the goal is that you'd align your life in head and hand and heart and life in the doorway with what God's Word wants you to be aligned with love of God, love of others, and so forth. That you would be conformed, that the thing is done not so you can have a big phylactery that really shows you care about these scriptures or a big phylactery on your arm, but that it's actually entered into your head and heart. There's the other thing they do. They make phylacteries wide, and the tassels on their garments are long. The tassels on the garments are something that we even find Jesus wearing in Matthew. Twice we're told about the fringes on his garments. A faithful Jew would have these little spaghetti-like things at the bottom of their shirt, and we're actually told the woman with the hemorrhage just wanted to touch the fringe of his garment. Jesus has these fringes. I wouldn't even doubt if Jesus was approving of phylacteries. It's not the symbols that are a problem. It's not that they're just bound to these outward observances and, you know, fringes are bad because they're not in the heart and the phylacteries are bad. It's what they've done. And if you notice, they make the phylacteries wide and the tassels long. In other words, they exaggerate them as much as possible. Why? So people will see. So you can't ignore that they've got their fringes and they've got their phylacteries. They are flaunting their piety as a fashion statement. It is that they've got the biggest and they've got the longest. And when that's there, then it's impossible not to see that. Jesus isn't against these symbols. What he's against is flaunting them. He's against using them as just an external way to gain others' approval rather than as a prompting to real piety and devotion. So that's another thing. And then he ends it by saying all of this comes because there's this deep craving of recognition and honor. So verse 6, they loved the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They loved to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. The place of honor, and we're not a shame honor culture for the most part. Western culture is not as focused on shame and honor as Eastern culture is, but we still understand it. If you're given an invitation to go to a wedding, to be at the bride's table is a much greater honor than to be way far away because you're closer to all the action. So that they loved that when they went to banquets, that they had the place of prominence, that it was obvious in a honor-shame society that they have the most honor. They're the most important. They're up there in front with whatever's going on in the party. Or at the temple, when it comes time for temple service, and we read that too, they love the most important seats in the synagogue. You know what the most important seat in a synagogue is? As close to the Torah as you can be. Right up front where the Torah is. That you are as close to the law as possible. And the reason they wanted to be as close to the law as possible is to show how distant they were from everyone else. That they are the ones that are most honorable, most important. They care the most about the law, the Torah, while everyone else is at a great distance. They don't really care as much, and they're certainly not as important. So their whole reason to hold to this power was for prominence, notoriety, recognition, honor. The focus wasn't on a closeness to God. The focus was on the distance that there was from others. Well, Jesus sees all of this, and these are accusations are scathing. They just get at the very heart of abuses of power. These people are leading for all the wrong reasons when it comes to spirituality, when it comes to faith. You could argue differently if we're talking about business or politics, where power is meant to be flaunted, where you want to be at front, you want people to know, without me, this state goes under. But when it comes to faith and religion, it's not this that gains God's recognition. It actually gains Jesus' prophetic condemnation. So he takes this last phrase, they love to have men call them rabbi, and then he begins to chip away at all that's wrong with this in order that we might understand what is it like to be a faithful leader. Verse 8, but you are not to be called rabbi, for you only have one master and you are all brothers. And if you were to underline any phrase there, that's important. You're all brothers. What's important is not one of you is above the other and other is below, but you're all in an equal field. You're all brothers and sisters. You're all part of the same family. So don't use these titles to make it so that you put yourself above the rest. You're all in the same family. And verse 8, do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. Now, people have gone out of their way to take this and get very Pharisaical when it comes to you shouldn't be called a rabbi. You shouldn't be called a teacher, and you know, Catholics ought not call people father. Well, that's not what's going on here, because Paul will actually say in his epistles, he considers himself a spiritual father. We'll read about the gift of pastor, teacher, and other things. The issue isn't the title as much as the title making a grand distance between another. As a title making it so that the one who holds it feels like they are above the rest, because as Jesus says, you're all brothers, and you have one master, and one teacher, and one father ultimately. You are all in this family, and in that way you're all equals. Which is to say, the way we do it in our modern culture, Reverend Rich with your Master of Divinity. Reverend Pastor Father Dr. Rich. And sadly, I can't take to myself the title Doctor. I'd love to. Because if I had a PhD, you'd have to call me Dr. Rich Vincent. Because that's a lot of work. I'd get over it and I'd get past that. But for a while, I'd want to be called Doctor. That's. And then I might change my last name to Strange. But that's a whole other story. What's that? What's up, Doc? That'd be fun to have people say that. But when you think about it, at the end of the day, you know, I am ordained. I am a reverend. I do have a Master of Divinity, but what I always do, and Emma, close your ears, is I think, Master of Divinity, nobody masters divinity. I mean, I guess you got to call it something, but at best it should be servant of divinity, or, you know, keen follower or attentive listener or instructed student or something. But that whole idea of mastering divinity has always taken me a little bit in the wrong direction, although I don't know what else you call it. Paul had a better phrase. He said, may people consider us servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God, which I've always liked better. That's 2 Corinthians 4. He says, call me a servant of Christ and a steward of the mysteries of Christ, which I've always thought is wonderful. But the idea with that is you have a stewardship. It's not that you have any great position or prominence. A steward just takes what is someone else's and tries to use it accountably. The steward isn't the leader. The steward's just simply a steward. And Paul begins that by saying, I'm a servant of Christ. Paul doesn't use the language that we use of leader. Paul uses the language of servant. He never uses that kind of language. That language is not in the Bible. You're a leader. Instead, it's you're a follower of Christ. You're a servant at best. And that means the whole philosophy of leadership always has to be questioned and critically examined, particularly when business leadership or the newest leadership styles are crunched into a pastoral role. Because there's something foreign about that. Jesus, who shows us the way of leadership, leads us to a cross. The Jesus who shows us the way of power shows us the way of vulnerability and humility. So that it seems to me like the kind of leadership style of Jesus wouldn't work in IBM. And it wouldn't work in any kind of business setting. And I don't think it'd work within any kind of political structure that I'm aware of. It just doesn't work because it's a different way of doing things. Jesus wants us to know that every one of us are equal. And when we focus on someone and make them above everyone else, then we're working in the way of the powers of the world rather than in the way of the power of God revealed in Christ, because we're always followers. Which is why when I look at this passage, my big deal is not don't call me father or reverend or any of that. For me, the big issue is there in verse 10. Nor are you to be called teacher, and this is the important thing, you have one teacher, the Christ. If a pastor is charged to do anything else, the pastor is charged to make sure the congregation knows you have one master and one teacher, and it's not me, it's Christ. My hope is that I'd be in some way an instrument of passing on that teaching, of testifying of it. But at the end of the day, Jesus is our teacher. He's my teacher. He's your teacher. He's our teacher. We're trying to walk in the way of Jesus. I'm doing the best I can as Rich Vincent to understand that way of Jesus, but the sad thing for all of you is the best you'll ever get is the way of Christ according to Rich Vincent, which is horribly narrow and incredibly, you know, small-minded in contrast to all that Christ really wants to share with you, in all the ways Christ really wants to draw you into the embrace of God. So that the pastor should remind the people again and again, Christ is our, we're trying to learn the way of the Christ who is our teacher, who points us to God the Father, who calls us all to be brother and sister, who invites us to live in this family, and the way we're to live in it is if God has granted me the gift of pastor teacher, and I believe God has, that I do my very best to use that and utilize it and make the most of it to serve God's people. To allow God's people to understand that Christ has called all of us into the way of being leading servants. So it seems that at the end of the day, what Christ is really getting at with this abuse of religion is this claiming to honor God, but at the end of the day, really pointing all the fingers at oneself. To get the admiration, to get approval, to show that there's a superior piety. And what's wonderful about this passage is the very ones who want the honor of the superior position, Jesus shames. That's what he's been doing in our passage so far. He is shaming again and again the ones that want the most honor. In order to speak about where true honor is found, and we're going to find in the concluding verses we look at tonight that true honor is found in the way of service and ultimately in the way of humility. So verse 11 is where he really begins to instruct his disciples. The greatest among you, verse 11, will be your servant. So we have the beginning of the new way, and the new way is the greatest is the servant. Now I'm sure by now you've heard of the phrase servant leader. It's even made great headway in business leadership structures, and people will talk about servant leaders, and it's a very popular and interesting phrase, and I think that's a helpful thing that it's made its way into business and into the world. However, I still think the focus is wrong with servant leaders, because the main noun with servant leaders is leader. I actually prefer the phrase leading servants, where the main noun is the servant. And what the servant is doing is trying in some way to guide or direct or to influence or to lead. Because Jesus says the greatest among you will not be a leader. Instead, the greatest among you will be a servant. And a servant is quite interesting, particularly in Jesus' day. A servant seeks above and beyond all else the approval of the master. The one that the servant is bound to seek to find approval from is ultimately their Lord, their master. They're not trying to impress the other servants. It doesn't matter what the other servants think of their service. What matters is what the master thinks of their service. And so that's why I think Jesus and Paul are bound to make servanthood this major idea of quote-unquote leadership in the Christian church, that the idea is not being so focused on what fellow servants think as much as try to please the master. Make sure you're seeking that approval first and foremost, and the way to do that is by actually serving. So you have in the final verse we're looking at tonight this call to humility. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So it seems that the key to being a leading servant is humility. And this is where I think it all can go sideways for us Westerners. Because generally speaking, you've been under my leadership for 10 years, so maybe you've begun to veer into the roadway I'd like you to be in. But for the most part, when people think of humility, they think, I'm not worthy, I'm a worm, I have no value, you know, God is God and I am not, and that just means I'm wretched and I just need to understand that I am a sinner. And humility tends to revolve around, I'm a sinner. The problem with that, Jesus says, I am gentle and humble in heart. What do we believe about Jesus? He's sinless. He doesn't sin. He lives in the way of obedience to God's Torah, even when it leads to the cross. So the sinless one says, I am meek and humble of heart. So we understand humility isn't directly related to sin. It's not directly related to that, if you will, at all, because Jesus shows us the greatest act of humility in what he does. So any type of humility that leads to self-deprecation or just groveling or saying we're just all sinners anyway is not humility that Jesus is speaking about here. That's why I think the better way to look at humility is to understand that humility is to recognize quite accurately, as best as you can assess, what are the gifts I have? What are the abilities I have? What can I bring to the table? What do I have to offer? While all the while understanding, no matter what I have to offer, it doesn't make me better than anyone else. Because there's a lot that others have to offer. And there's a lot that others have to contribute. This is why I have a couple of quotes. I hope they help you in your understanding of humility. Diogenes Allen, a wonderful professor of theology. I think he was at Yale, maybe at Princeton. Is it Princeton? In his book, Love, he says, being humble is not to denigrate our actual talents and achievements, nor to lie about ourselves. It is rather to recognize the truth that our possessions, talents, and accomplishments do not raise us above others, which is pretty much what I said. He says it better. My favorite definition of humility, though, to this day, and I admonish each of you, if you've never read it, Mere Christianity is worth reading, on the whole. But the chapter on pride, in my opinion, is the single greatest chapter that Lewis has ever penned in getting right at the heart of what is wrong with pride and what humility is. And that chapter alone is worth reading. And in that chapter, and I've shared this before because I think this is such a good understanding of humility, he says in his own, you just can't imitate this way. Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who's always telling you that, of course, he's a nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. That's not what I would suggest our modern culture associates with humility. You know, they think of that greasy, smarmy, like Lewis says, this, but if you tell them they did a good job, oh, I really didn't. You know, go on, but I really didn't do that good a job. We're not talking about that at all. And we're certainly not talking about what I experienced the first 10 years of my ministry, and humility means, well, we're just all wretched, worm-like sinners. I mean, we're just nothing. Instead, it's an awareness that you have gifts to bring to the table, but they never make you better. They never set you above. They never make you superior. And in fact, any gift you've been given ultimately is for the sake of others. That's what every spiritual gifts chapter in the Bible is about. That you've been given gifts not for your own selfish promotion, but for others. So that you then yourself become a gift to others, a gift of God that's shaped as only you can shape it. This is Lewis in a nutshell, and I thought this really summarizes that lengthy quote in a wonderful aphorism. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it is thinking of yourself less. And that's really good. I don't think Lewis actually said that. I think that's a person taking what we just read and putting that in a bit more aphoristic package. And then I thought this, which says the same thing, really gets it across. Humility isn't thinking less of yourself. No one likes me. I'm not worthy. Everyone's better than me. It's thinking of yourself less, which is to say, can I help you with that? Can I be a gift? Can I be someone who allows the gifts God has given me to be of use to you as well? If you want to put all of this in one package and in one image, I think this image says it the best. That what Jesus is getting at in the first 8 verses is, here's the boss and here's the rest. And they're weighed down with all the heavy burdens. This one's not willing in any way to move them, but he certainly is going to force them to move them, and he's going to make darn well sure they recognize who's at top. Who's on the pedestal? Who should be in the position of prominence and importance? But what Jesus is really inviting this person to do, if they really want to be a leader, is to get off the pedestal and be a leading servant. To be the one that's actually moving in front, saying, this is the way. The one who's actually taking the burden upon themselves as well, practicing what they preach, taking the same load and offering what they can, which, if you think about it, this is what Jesus does. Jesus doesn't stay up in high heavens and shout down, hey guys, you know, live better. Instead, Jesus, not considering himself better than others, even though he was God, Philippians 2 will say, and he was in the form of God, took on the form of a servant and humbled himself to the point of obedience, even obedience of the cross. So that Jesus gets down in the muck, in the mire, and the dirt with us, which is really where the word humility comes from. It has as its root humus, this idea of being earthy, that you're down in the dirt, you're with everyone else at the foot of the cross, saying that I'm here not to serve, not to lead from a pedestal, but to serve in the same place you are. Because you can't serve from a pedestal. It's impossible. You can only be the boss. And that's what's wrong with the Pharisees in our story. Now, if the Christian community refuses to learn from this, next week we'll pick up with verse 13. If we refuse to hear this, Jesus, like the greatest prophets, has 7 woes where he's just going to flat out say, curse to you, or woe to you, or deep warning to you. You are headed for a cliff unless you learn the way of the leading servant, unless you learn the way of humility. You're headed towards disaster. And so we'll look at that next week as we come to part 2 of this chapter, and we'll cover the rest of it at that time. Let me offer a word of prayer, then we'll have a few minutes just to interact if we'd like. Gracious God, we are grateful for the model you have given us in Christ, who left the heights of glory to come in humility, to dwell with us, to share our sorrows, our sufferings, our hardships, our sickness, to become one with us, to walk this earth side by side, to carry our sin, to become one of us in order that we might embrace and be embraced by you, our Father. We are grateful for the leadership that he expresses. We ask that you would keep us far from all the pitfalls of seeking others' approval first and not yours. That you keep us from the pitfall of wanting to be prominent instead of humble. That you keep us from the pitfall of not practicing what we preach, from adding burdens to others and exempting ourselves from those same things. Allow us to walk in humility, and in that humility to know joy. The joy of knowing that you are able to use the gifts we have, the abilities we have, the voice we have to lead and to prompt our brothers and sisters, and indeed even this world, in the way of Christ, a new way of leadership, unlike any other, a way that best expresses your kindness, your grace, your love, and your compassion. So lead us in that way. Guide us in what we do. Forgive us when we fail. In the name of Christ, amen. Worship team, make your way up here as they are. Questions, comments, thoughts on the first 12 verses here? Laura, up here. You got a mic, Emma? I think you do, yes.
So you were talking about C.S. Lewis,
I haven't, but Chris Arndt told me I should, just recently. Okay.
Positive. And it has, for me anyways, it really hit home because that man was walking and was kind of feeling bad about himself.
Right.
I forgot that it was next to him. And I used to worry so much about it. I'd see somebody that wasn't, that looked like they were unhappy. And I'd go, what did I do? And then when I realized, don't read into it, secondly, don't take it personally, it just unburdened that person that, was. Probably just having a rough day.
Okay.
From, my thinking was about me.
Right.
Anyways, I thought the programs was a really good program.
Very good. You're the second or third person that's suggested I read that. Okay.
Of course you don't read anything. Of course you don't read it personally.
Well, and that brings up how very challenging it is, I think, to actually deal with humility. The fact that Jesus can say, I am gentle and humble of heart, unless he's truly gentle and humble of heart, how do you say that? So that there's some self-effacing part of Jesus, if you will, or being unconcerned of how you might hear that. And Paul does the same thing a number of times where he'll say, good things about himself and say, it doesn't really matter what you guys think, this is how it is, that he has integrity and he's doing it, I don't think by lifting himself up, but he's just willing to say, I'm not really concerned what you think, I'm just trying to be as honest as I can. I have to look into that book.
Well, because, being sensitive, I thought, was a good quality, but sometimes it can be kind of selfish quality, too. If you take it personally, it's not all about.
Right, right. Very good, very good. Yeah, my Chris is back there. My first pastor had on his desk, "It's not about you," a sign that said, "It's not about you," and I always thought that was fun. He just had it prominently on his desk all the time. Chris. Right, very small portion.
Do you think that the reason why Jesus made a lot of his parables, a lot of his teachings, a lot of his messages be about the servant and, becoming a servant and everything like that, is because of the situation that Israel and all the Israelites were in, was that they were under the Roman oppression. They were servants at the time. So, do you think there might have been like a double meaning kind of thing? Like, okay, we're servants, we're our servants that are Rome's leadership, so we also need to do what our master says to an extent,
Maybe where I think the intersection would be, if you think about it, the original gospel statement, here's the gospel, Kurios Christos, not Kurios Caesaris. Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not. And so that whole idea is we are still servants. We do have a master, but the master is not Caesar, the son of God, the good news of Rome, but it is Jesus, the son of God, the good news of God the Father. So I think there could be some level of that. Parenthesis is we all could learn in our society to try to divorce ourselves from that and understand that to say Jesus is Lord is always to be opposed to the political powers, no matter whether they're on your side or not, in some way, and to be critical. But you have that idea of that Jesus is Lord. But I also think, Chris, since they are so illiterate, 98% illiteracy, you had to be privileged and have money and influence and in a very distinctly important position to actually learn to read text. I think because of that, people were deeply engaged with memory. So where we all write it down and then we can forget it and look to our notes somewhere or type it in our computer and then it's stored away and I can revisit it, the ancient people were people of deep memory so that they would remember, you know, and they'd talk about what did Jesus just say and remember it. And I think that's why he uses aphorisms and the stories, because stories are always easy to remember than do this, do this, do this, don't do this. So I think you have that kind of going along as well. So the two things, but... good comment, good thoughts. Yeah, up here. Hey, Gina. Good to see you. Well, last question up here with Gina.
I guess it's not really a question. It's just something that I can observe when I'm kind of looking at that picture of both. You know, stepping ahead and trying to be a leader, it's really hard nowadays when you do that. And you really are trying to be helpful, maybe pass something on that you know to try to help people to improve in what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people's attitudes nowadays is, who are you to tell me what to do?
Mm-hmm.
Like they read what you're kind of saying, like they read into it, like instead of going, okay, well, she has something to offer, she does really well, maybe if we would listen, we learn something and we could do better, their attitude is like, why should we listen to you? You're not our boss. Like,
right.
You're trying to tell us what to do when you're really not trying to come out that way. You're just trying to help.
Right.
But that's just how people are.
Well, not just now. They crucified Jesus. It's always the case. You know, it's not just now. And I think the thing that I'd throw out there is maybe it's not so much that we need to be in a position where we tell them what to do, but they show them the way. We show them how we're living. We show them through our actions a better way. You know, it may demand more of that and an awareness that simply going ahead of someone doesn't mean they'll follow. And I'm not responsible if they follow or not. I'm just responsible to go ahead of them. What I'm not to do is to get behind them and push them. That's not leadership. That's bullying. And I'm not to get on the pedestal and demand them. That's being a tyrant. I'm actually to get in front and say this. And that's, of course, what Jesus does. Even when he's the last one showing the way on the road to the cross. He's the last one showing the obedience all the way to the end. So that might be one thing. But, of course, people are always frustrating. But sometimes we're the people. I know that I've been in that road where people have tried to guide me and show me the right way. And just ain't going to happen until I stumble enough that I'm ready to listen. So keep at it. Keep going in the right way. You know the right way. And that's what's most important. And do your best. The four agreements. Do your best. And be good, as E.T. says. All right. Worship team will lead us in song. And as they do, we'll collect our prayer request and go to the throne of grace.